Accession number 106 00, reel 5.
Mr. John Wainwright, reel 5. Did the Turkish attack on the canal, the abortive Turkish attack on the canal, did that affect your unit at all?
No, we knew when we heard about this attack, and we knew that units of our, above the 42nd Division were on duty on the canal, and part of the artillery of the division, and we knew that the attack had been repulsed and a lot of Turks had been captured, and actually we knew that they'd been sent to a camp down the line from Cairo to a place probably 20 or 30 miles south of Cairo, which later on was used as a prisoner of war camp generally for the Turks captured in Gallipoli.
Did the fact that the Turks were beaten back so easily, did it affect your opinion of what the Turkish would be like as infantry, as the enemy?
Well, not being there, we didn't know exactly, because we got the idea that the Turks had a tremendous hard journey across Palestine and Sinai to get to the canal. By the time they got there, they would probably be very, 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 very tired and so forth, and probably not in fighting trim.
You actually thought that at the time?
Well, that was the sort of feeling, yes, yes.
So you didn't write them off as a result?
I don't think so. We came to realise later on that the Turk was a very good fighter, very good soldier.
What was the next event you remember? You carried on your training.
Well, there were rumours rife in around about March, I think it was, that there was likely to be an attack somewhere in the Mediterranean by British troops against the Turks. There were rumours and rumours, but we didn't know exactly where this was going to take place.
How would these rumours spread, or how would they start? Have you any idea?
You're asking me. It's amazing how rumours did spread in the army, all sorts of things. It's amazing the rumours we got of this, that and the other. Someone started it off, and off it went round like wildfire. But there was that feeling. And then later on, there was a big parade that we were told that General Hamilton, Ian Hamilton, of whom we'd never heard up to the time, was going to inspect the division along with Sir John Maxwell, who was the general officer commanding of the Army of Occupation in Egypt. And that we should take part in this, in this parade. This parade was on in March or April sometime.
Is this the Palm Sunday one?
It was on Palm Sunday, yes. Because I remember as we were marching through the city, we saw all these palms in the street, you know, because there is a Coptic church, a Christian church, in Egypt. They were called the Copts, and they had a great celebration for Palm Sunday.
What do you remember of the march past the inspection?
Well, I remember it as far as our battalion was concerned. We had the usual parades, section and company and battalion parade before we eventually joined the battalion and the division. So it took hours getting ready for this raid, going through the normal procedures, and then we marched off as a battalion. And joined up the other battalions in order, presumably. And we just marched through the city and past Shepherd's Hotel, which was a very big hotel in Egypt, well known and I think was used as a sort of headquarters for the division. Seemed to be something of the sort. I remember that the entrance to this hotel was up a tremendous flight of steps, stone steps. And on the top was a sort of balcony, and I remember the generals being there and all the staff officers. And I was for some reason or other that day I was in charge of the signal section, whether the sergeant was on sick or on some other duty, I don't remember. And the position on a parade was for the for the signals to precede the battalion. So it was my job to head the battalion in front of the signal section, and it was all with, we were all with fixed bayonets, you know, and sloping arms, and it was my job to give the eyes right to the generals on the step, which I was very proud of, I suppose. So I had the job of giving the eyes right for the signal section, first of the battalion. And remember, that's just and that's about all I remember, except sort of going back to barracks and the bands playing and seeing all these decorations, palm leaves and whatnot.
There was no sort of speech to the men of the division by any of the generals or...?
No, well, the usual thing normally after a parade like that, that it seemed to be the sort of procedure that the officer taking the parade would send an official message to the general of the division. In our case, was Major General Douglas, and this would be published in battalion orders, saying said how much he was impressed by the look of the parade and so forth and soldierly bearing and so forth and so forth. Actually, what he was doing was, he knew he'd been appointed to take charge of the operations in the Dardanelles. We found out later, of course. And he knew that we were there in Egypt, and that we should probably be brought into the affray. And he was coming to look over, see what he thought of these territorials. Because we were the first territorial division to go abroad as a division. We'd been trained as a division out in Egypt for all the 6 months, very, very hard training. And he came to eye us over and see what he thought about us. That's the feeling I got.
Were you proud of being territorials?
Oh yes, I think we were. Well, of course we were.
Did you see yourself, you know, as...
Well, we looked upon ourselves as volunteers. I mean, we did it voluntarily. And not just when the war broke out, but a year or two before. Because at the back of our minds, we were joining because something was going to happen. And people would be wanted. And... We were proud to belong to the regular regiments and so forth.
What did you think of the regulars? Did you look up to them as better soldiers?
Well, obviously, yes, they were better trained than obviously people who had been in the army for years and in many cases and trained. So they were well trained and disciplined and so forth, and we looked at them as being our superiors, really.
Now, another thing I know you mentioned to me earlier was a forced march you did shortly after this, the big inspection, to Helwan. What do you remember about that?
This march to after the inspection was a march on hard metal road. Our division had been traced mainly on the desert and not on sand, soft ground. And then presumably it was thought that if we went to Gallipoli, that's the feeling that I've got anyway, that there'd be a lot of marching on hard metal roads because we were supposed to be going to Constantinople eventually. And I think that was the feeling right away. We were going to do a lot of... have to do a lot of marching and so on. So it was arranged that there should be this divisional march to Helwan.
It wasn't the same day as the
parade. I can't tell you the exact date. I've probably got it down somewhere, but I should think it would be probably the beginning of April or the end of March. And I think it must have been something like a 50 or 60 mile march. And the idea was we would march during the day there and have a rest and then come back again during the following night. But this was something where the troops weren't used to marching on hard roads. And by the time we got to Helwan, I mean, people's feet were blistered and all the rest of it. And
what about your feet? How did they...
Well, I don't think I was as bad as a lot of people. I don't remember that I was as bad as some, but most of them had trouble with the feet, and lots of blisters galore.
Did you take any special care of your feet?
Well, during the march, you mean?
No. Well, I mean, before, you know, just generally, during a march like that, or generally, did you have any methods of avoiding damage to your feet?
Well, the normal thing is, I mean, you've got good fitting boots, you see. You've got decently fitting boots, and you add socks and so on. It's just like in civilian life, that if you've got good fitting boots, you could march along comfortably.
And yours fitted you well?
Oh, yes, they were quite well fitted. So I don't know that we took any special precaution, because, well, what precaution could you take, really? You just had your socks on and boots on, and you were just doing the marching, and off you went in the heat of the sun. But that was a great trouble, that instead of coming back the same night, we rested until the following day.
Did the heat cause any problems on a march like that?
No, what I found out in Egypt was, although sometimes you've got it very, very hot, you know, probably up to 120 in the shade, if there was any shade, probably more in the sun, but it was a very dry heat, you know. And then we were dressed too, according. We had khaki drill, khaki shorts and khaki tunics and so on. So, and then we had pith helmets, you know, sun helmets, light pith helmets. So we were dressed for the occasion. The heat was dry heat, you know, and you could stand a lot better. My experience is that you can stand dry heat much, much better than the humid heat you get in Lancashire. You get 70 or 80 degrees here, and it's humid, but jolly sight harder to bear than the 110, 115, 120 out in the desert in Egypt.
Did you have spine pads?
No, we had what were called, what did we call them now? We had a sort of a thing that attached to the back of your helmet and went over the back of your neck, you know. I forgot what we called them, but it was just some sort of khaki cloth that was made specially fitted. And you had those on the back of the cervical cavity. But with a pith helmet, you know, that protected you to some extent, even to the back of your neck.
Do you remember any other last final training during April and moving into the first couple of days of May before you left on the 3rd?
No, I don't remember anything in particular. We were becoming very adept by this time with both the semaphore, heliograph and Morse code. We were very well trained in our job, and I think we enjoyed it too.
When did you first hear about the possibility of going to Gallipoli?
Well, there again, the rumours came out at the end of April.
Were there rumours about Gallipoli?
We'd heard something. We heard that there had been an attack.
Were there any rumours about a landing at Gallipoli before the first landing? Or was the first you heard of it after the landing?
The first we heard was after the landing. I mean, almost immediately after the landing, we heard that there'd been a landing. And it was in the Dardanelles, that's what we... Some of us hardly knew where the Dardanelles was, except it was somewhere in the Mediterranean or off the Aegean Sea. That was the first that we heard of it. And there'd been tremendous casualties and so forth, and there was the feeling, the rumour was that we should be going out. So by early in April, we got the orders were given. I think the orders were given about the end of April that we should be prepared to embark, and we embarked. We did on the 3rd of
May.
3rd of May, yes.
So what kit were you taking with you? What was your
Well, we'd had the light khaki drill out in Egypt, and we were immediately kitted out with the old winter khaki clothing, which wasn't very much appreciated. It was very, very hot at that time of the year in Egypt.
So you had to hand your khaki drill back in.
We handed we had to hand our kit bags in. We were only allowed to take active service gear out with us, a certain limit to what we could take out. So our spare kits and so forth were left in our kit bags, and a khaki drill and so forth.
And what was your active service kit?
Well, our active service kit actually was this khaki uniform. We still kept our pith helmets for some unknown reason to me. We had kept the pith helmets. We had this heavy khaki uniform, and then there was a minimum of we had overcoats, a very thick overcoat, heavy overcoat, and then there's a normal knife, fork, spoon, hussif, and towel, and that's about all as far as I can remember.
What about your rifle? Which rifle did you have?
We were at the beginning of the war, or before the war, we were issued with what was called the Longley Enfield rifle. The regular army by this time had got the Shortley Enfield, but we ended up with a Longley Enfield.
And that's what you took to
that's
Gallipoli?
That's what we took to Gallipoli.
What about your webbing and bandoliers and such like? What pattern were they?
Well, I mean, there was the leather things. The bandolier that fitted diagonally across your chest, you know, and the pouches and so on. So we had the water bottle, you know, on one side. You had the ensenching tool on the back, and you had a haversack which you had your emergency ration, I think it was, and you'd have your towel, knife, fork, and spoon, and what have you.
You'd been given the first aid package as well in your
tunic. Oh yes, that was it. That was in part on. So it was part of the tunic. On the inside of the tunic was this emergency first aid pack, and also we had an emergency ration too. We had an emergency ration which you were not allowed to use under any circumstances unless you were given permission by your officer commanding.
So this was the kit you were about to go to war in. What happened then? On the 3rd of May you left... You were at Cairo. When did you left Cairo to go to Alexandria?
We left Cairo. We left on the 2nd, and then travelled over, and then we embarked on the Derfflinger, which was a German ship that had been captured from the Germans, presumably, on the outbreak of war, and that had been used for taking troops, the regular troops, who made their landing in Gallipoli. And this same ship had just come back, and we could plainly see it when we got on board. Because, I mean, there were signs of all sort of blood and goodness knows what, and odds and ends strewed about the place. It was a bit of a shambles, because they'd just arrived and brought this 4,500 prisoners, wounded people, and they had been taken off, and went on straight aboard. So we were met with signs of war right away.
Did you clean it? Were the ship cleaned up by the battalion?
Well, that'd be one of our duties to keep everything clean and tidy. But it was there to be seen. I mean, I remember this all this blood and stuff about, even on the. Well, it was there anyway. So we had a baptism, all right, of. What to expect when we got there.
Did it affect morale?
Oh, I don't think so, no. I don't think so.
Were you very worried about what might happen yourself? Did you worry about the future?
It's amazing, I mean, you never worried about these things, at least that was my impression. You'd gone abroad to do a job, you know, we were expecting sooner or later to go on active service. We knew it wasn't a picnic, and we knew very well that there was going to be some hard times ahead. And I mean, it just took them. I can never remember being worried about it, particularly. It was just part of the job.
What was your accommodation like in the Derfflinger? You weren't on a long, but...
Oh, I don't know. We seemed to be sleeping about anywhere, as far as I can't remember anything. Just sleeping where we could on the ship.
Did it take you direct to Hellas?
Yes, Louise, yes. I remember when... Went north from Alexandria and then up the Aegean, probably going mainly north, I suppose. I remember going past Rhodes, somebody said that's Rhodes Island or something. And off we went, and then we saw, later on we could see some other land on our right-hand side, whatever that be. And probably Asia Minor, I suppose. And then some of the islands, we saw Tenedos, I think it was. And then eventually we got towards to the Dardanelles, and then we had signs of warships and shells. You could see the shells. We saw the land there, and we could see the shells landing. We could hear the rifle fire and so forth. Because the landing which had been made at Helles never got more than a few miles inland, as you know. So that was it.
So how was the actual disembarkation from the Derflinger and landing? You landed at W Beach, I think. Tell me how it was actually done.
Well, it was done actually. We disembarked from the big ship onto smaller vessels, sort of trawlers, I suppose. And actually, we landed on the River Clyde. You know, the River Clyde had been used in the landing.
That's V Beach.
V Beach and W Beach, yeah. V Beach, for the Lancashire Fusiliers, and we actually landed onto the River Clyde, and then went over from a sort of jetty onto the beach there at V Beach.
What were your first impressions of V Beach? What state was it in, and what could you see?
Well, it was getting in the afternoon, and there were stray shells coming over whilst we were there. Nothing quite near to us, but there were some dropping into the sea, some on land. You could hear the shells and bursting in. You could hear rifle fire and so forth. I don't know. We just accepted it.
What was happening on the beach?
Nothing except disembarking. I mean, we had to disembark, and there were all the stores had to be disembarked, and we had to help on with that. And then we just bivouacked just behind the cliffs of W Beach. We stayed there a night.
You moved round to W Beach, then?
Just round the corner, not very far. Yes, V Beach and the W was just round the coast anyway. So there was sort of cliffs there, and we were sheltered from the sea, but not sheltered from the land. So we were facing towards Achibaba, which is the objective we had to capture, to if we were going to capture the Dardanelles.
Was the beach area, with the two beach areas, were they well organised? Were they setting up the stores and the base camp? Because it's only, you landed on the 6th, I think, of May.
Yeah.
That's only about 9 days after the landing. Ten days. How organised had the beaches
become? Well, it seemed to go very well. And I had to help in the getting of the stores over, and then the battalion we just moved around the corner and we just bivouacked for the night there. I remember it was the tail end of the winter too up in the Aegean, and it was a very cold night. I remember we just come from Egypt, and we were there. Of course, we just slept on the floor. That was it, where we could. I remember it was a very, very cold night. And during the night, you could still hear the firing going on, because I say it was what, only 9 or 10 days after the landing. So we just had one day there, and then next day, the very next day, we sort of started moving up to the trenches in sections.
What kind of terrain were you moving across? What would you describe the type of ground and the vegetation
it was just sort of moorland, that sort of thing. It wasn't actually moorland, but it was that type of thing, just sort of seemed to be like gorse and that sort of, just like moorland sort of cover.
Rough scrub land,
yes, in a way. There are very few buildings about. Hardly any buildings at all, and this scrubland, and then there were these nullahs, sort of ravines that, coming from Achibaba, they were cut down into the land, and these gullies 20, 30 feet deep, streams coming down, these coming towards the sea.
Which route did you take up to? You said you moved up the second day towards the front lines. Which route did you take?
Well, we were going up towards the Krithia Nulla part of the way. Before we got to that, it was on open land. And there was a lot of open land because the trenches had never been, hadn't been actually completed right across there. You could imagine that, 7 or 8 days. And there were a series of trenches up and down. So we went out in the open, and we went in what was called this in sections an artillery formation, like a diamond formation. So the idea was, that had been practiced out in Egypt, of course, this advancing in the open. The idea was, instead of going en masse, you went in this diamond formation, an artillery formation.
What each section was
in? In each section, so that if a shell burst, there was always a chance it would come in between the sort of diamond and the section. And then we moved there, and we had to get down all that. Because we were in the opening, you know, and the Turks were up above, you know. So they could
see where they were?
They could see what we could see. We could see Ashibaba there, and we could see the Krithia village, and we could see the firing going on only hundreds of yards in front of us, a mile at the outside. I doubt if it was a mile. And there were the odd shells coming over. So we would advance for certain distance, and then in order to we'd get down on the ground. Because I remember that quite well, because it was such a nuisance that we got our full pack on. We got our rifles and full pack on. And then we got these confounded pith helmets. And the back that I told you about, the projector from the back, caught the back of your pack when you got on the ground, I mean, sort of in firing position. The back of your pith helmet caught the back and knocked it forward. So much so that before very long there weren't many pith helmets left in Ardennes.
So you couldn't see?
You couldn't see. No, I knocked the thing over your eyes and they were just on the helmet.
So what did you do with them?
A lot of them, they were just skimmed away. They were thrown away.
Did you do that to yours?
Yes, I got rid of mine too, because I remember I wore a series of caps and things where I had a cap belonging to the Royal Scots, somebody who'd been killed off, obviously. Lying about, there were bodies like here and there lying about on the peninsula as we went forward. I had this, I think it was a Royal Scots cap, and then later on I had an Australian cap that I got there again. That was from an Australian who was lying there, from a chap who had been killed on the advance bread day or something, probably the day before. It was pretty hectic,
So what you were moving up in artillery formation in these diamonds.
Yeah.
Where did you get to?
Then we got into the reserve trenches.
And can you fix those? Was there any landmark near the reserve positions you took up?
Well, I mean the division we were given a place in the division actually, because at the actual landing there was the 29th division. We were on the extreme left, and then there was the Royal Naval Division next to them, and then there was a French expeditionary force on the right, and apparently the 42nd Division were given the position to the right of the 29th, and that went on for until after August. That on the left of the line were the 29th Division, next was the 42nd Division. To the left and the right of this Krithia Nullah, then on our right was the Royal Naval Division, and then further to the right was the French Expeditionary Force. A lot of Senegalese of them too.
So you got to this reserve line. What did it look like, the reserve line? What state was it in?
Well, they were reasonable sort of trenches, because there was more or less a line of trenches right across the peninsula. How they'd done it in the time, I don't know. It seems impossible. But the setup of the army is, you know, apart from the infantry, you've always got the engineers and army service corps and supporting troops. And the engineers are the ones who help digging the trenches too after a battle, getting the wires put in front of the line and so forth. So I suppose it must have been, I think the engineers must have done a marvellous job in that trench digging.
How deep was it?
Well, the trenches were, I mean, you could, they were probably 5 or 6, probably 6 feet deep. The trench might have been 5 feet deep, and then on top were the sandbags, you know, that were filled, sort of, and there was a step sort of on what we call a firing platform that you could step from there, and just put your rifle over the sandbags.
Were they in traverses?
Yes, they were in traverses. That was the sort of thing that every section was distinct from the next one.